Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. William Keyes IV. He's a former senior policy advisor to the White House and founder of the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. He serves on the Board of Trustees at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he's the author of The Stories They Hear, Expecting Greatness as the Key to Success. Welcome to the Exchange, Dr. Keyes.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So your book tells this extraordinary story of your mentoring relationship with hundreds of young Black men who experienced your Institute for Responsible Citizenship. And I'm anxious to learn more about your institute and dive into the stories they hear. But I'd like to start with your background. Tell me about you. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the little town of Washington, North Carolina, which is actually the first town in America named for George Washington. It's a wonderful little place, about 10,000 people. It's the kind of place where you never lock your doors. Now, I don't think it's the same way today, but that's the way it was 50 years ago when I left there. And then I went off to the University of North Carolina, where I had a great experience, and from there moved to Washington to work on Capitol Hill and on a White House staff, as you mentioned. Met my wife during that period, and we now are parents and of two kids, and we have now, as of 9 days ago, we have our fourth grandchild.
So hey, congratulations.
Thank you so much. So we've had three boys, and now we finally have a little girl, and everybody's pretty excited.
Nice. What was life like for you growing up?
It was like idyllic. You know, kind of hard to imagine that in a sense, having grown up in the South in the 50s, 60s, 70s. But it really was, just because in that small town, I had a tremendous amount of love and support all around me. And when we talk about expectations, you know, the subtitle of this book, Expecting Greatness as the Key to Success, that was the reality for me. I had parents who expected that I was going to do something with my life. They had no idea what that would be, but they expected me to do something. And likewise, I had teachers and pastors and all kinds of other people in my life who had high expectations for me. And fortunately, I lived up to their expectations.
Well, how did you find your passion and your path?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because one of the most important things we talk about in the Institute and in this book, you'll see that the very beginning, it talks about how God has blessed each of us with something special that he expects us to use for his glory, but also to be a blessing in the lives of others. And I'm encouraging people to really work hard to identify what that is. And I also tell them at their age, they probably have no clue what it is, and neither did I at their age. But I want them to accept that notion that there is something special about them. And so my path was circuitous. It wasn't a straight line. My goal when I was in college was to become a college football coach. Later, while I was in college, I fell in love with politics, left school, went and worked on a political campaign, which then led me to coming to Washington. While I was here, I was working, you know, almost 24/7 on politics. I was completely consumed by it. At some point, I got burned out on politics and decided to do something completely different, and I ended up selling life insurance. After a period of time, you know, when I recharged my battery, I came back to politics, and it was during that period that I ended up taking a job at Georgetown University where I ran a summer institute for young people who are interested in journalism, who came in from colleges around the country. And it was while I was doing that I fell in love with this idea of creating this type of an experience for talented young people to see how that would propel them to have success in their careers. And that, in that case, it was journalism and political journalism in particular. But I realized that it was a great opportunity, but there are a lot of young people who could really benefit from it, but they weren't there, and that was African-American men. So I would select 100 students into that program, and I never had more than 5 African-American students. And the year I had 5, 4 of them were women, only one man. And I decided, and by the way, part of the reason that they weren't there was, in some cases, that it was very expensive. And in other cases, because they didn't have mentors or advisors in their lives who directed them toward doing programs like that. And so I ended up creating the Institute with the idea that we would work explicitly with African-American men, and we would do this in a way that not only would they not have to pay to come, but we would actually pay them to come. So I was fortunate enough to be able to have a little money that my wife and I could pour into this, and we had friends who had money that they could pour into it. And still today, fortunately, this is a program that's run off the generosity of our friends and a growing network of people who see the value of what we're doing. But anyway, I just gave you a long, long boring story about my life and how
certainly not boring. That's quite a novel business model. In your book, you write about why you created the Institute, and you tell the parable of John White and John Black. Tell me about that.
Yes. Well, the short version of that parable, and I hope your listeners will order this book and read it. Not only your listeners, but their children or any other young people who they are involved with, who they're trying to help achieve success or even something greater than success, which is another story. But the story in the book, the parable of John White and John Black, really profiles two young men. This is a fictitious story, obviously, but it profiles two young men who are basically the same profile. They're friends. They're great friends. They go to the same school. They're both straight-A students. They're both star athletes. They're both involved in student government at school. And they're both active in their communities. And John White happens to receive all kinds of benefits and support just by virtue of the fact that he lives in a community where that kind of support is readily available. So it talks about his dad just walking down the driveway one day to grab the newspaper and having a neighbor pull up and say he had heard great stories about little Johnny at the high school. And there's this conversation that takes place between them that leads to little Johnny having a great internship in the field that he was interested in at that neighbor's company, and introductions to folks at the school that little Johnny White was interested in applying to, and then support from personal connections at that university when he enrolled there, et cetera, that led to other internships and invitations to conferences and all kinds of activities. And we really kind of spell out all of those different benefits that just came very easily for John White.
And he was put on a pathway to success.
Yeah. And then I'd say, now let's talk about John Black. And I pause for a minute in the video that we've done of this that's on our website. I pause because what folks say to me when I'm asking about John Black is, we don't need to talk about John Black. We don't need to worry about him. He's going to be fine. And what I've just noticed in so many cases is that talented young Black men who are working hard, who are achieving a lot, who are ambitious to go out and make a difference in the world, to be successful for reasons beyond just themselves, are often ignored. And people literally say, I don't have to worry about him. He's going to be fine. I read that W.E.B. Du Bois in 1910 wrote that he was trying to build a system of higher education for Negroes. And philanthropists would say, Du Bois, that's nice, but the kind of people who can take advantage of a higher education ought to be able to take advantage of ought to be able to take care of themselves. And when I read that, I pounded my desk and I thought, I'll be doggone, I'm dealing with the same thing a century later. The talented young white men and women, and to a significant degree, talented young Black women, receive a significant amount of support that's just not offered to talented young Black men. We don't need to worry about them. They're going to be fine. And so what we've done at the Institute is to say, okay, let's bridge that gap. Let's make sure that if John White gets a great internship, John Black is also going to get a great internship. John White has mentors in his life who are giving him great advice and direction. We're going to make sure John Black has mentors in his life who give him great advice and direction. We bridge that gap in those experiences, exposure, and so forth. And the results have been pretty phenomenal. So in 22 years, we've been in business. We've had 300 young men go through the Institute. And those 300 young men include 5 Rhodes Scholars, 15 graduates of Harvard Law School, a member of the New York State Supreme Court, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital and doctors at other leading hospitals in the country, pastors of great churches, professors at great universities. So these young men are achieving some pretty extraordinary things. And like we say, for reasons that are bigger than themselves. And many of them would say, I would not have been able to do this had I not come to the Institute. And even got in the encouragement to attempt to do some of these things that they're doing. And so that's what this is about. I am extremely proud of all of these young men and all the things that they're doing. But I can't say it enough, that it's not just an investment in 300 young men. It's an investment in the millions of people whose lives will be impacted by the work that these 300 young men do.
No doubt, no doubt. My guest is Dr. William Keyes IV. He's the author of The Stories They Hear, Expecting Greatness as the Key to Success. So, Dr. Keyes, why did you write this book?
Well, I think that's really the important question, the question of the moment. Why did we write this book? People ask me all the time, how is it possible that these young men who go through the Institute end up doing so well? And, you know, I ask them, you know, back, well, what do you think it is? And they tell me all their reasons, you know, great selection process, great mentoring, you know, great classes, great internships, all of those things. And all of those things are important, but lots of people do all of those things. And so the one thing that we do that's different from everyone else is the conversations that we have around the dinner table. That that subtitle, Expecting Greatness, is the Key to Success. How do we communicate those expectations? We do that through those conversations around the dinner table. How do we communicate the values that we think are really important for people to be selfless enough and humble enough to go out and work hard to make a difference in the world to benefit other people? We communicate those and other values through those conversations we have around the dinner table. So I can't invite everybody to come sit at the dinner table with us, but I thought for the folks who are scout troop leaders or youth pastors or teachers or professors or anyone else, parents, of course, who are in the business of trying to help young people be successful, it would be beneficial for them to hear these stories. Some of what they're going to read, some of what your listeners are going to read in this book might be a little counterintuitive. We're not saying the same things that everybody else says. But I think what we're saying, not I think, I know that what we are saying is working, and the success of these young men is the proof of it. So I wrote the book just to be able to share some of that with the idea that, you know, I'm taking 12 young men at a time, you know, but the need is so much greater than that. And I can't do it all, but there are other people who I think if they hear these lessons, hear these stories, it might better equip them to be able to go out and make a difference. By the way, these stories would not just benefit young Black men, though that's the focus of my efforts. It'll help anyone, young white women, you know, or, you know, young people who are early in their careers, you know, whether they're in college, maybe they're in high school, whatever. But I think the stories are, you know, ones that can be thought of as universal. And so there again, hopefully people will grab this book, The Stories They Hear.
Well,
who are they? There are some pretty extraordinary people. And these are the stories that they hear around our dinner table every summer.
Well, it sounds like journalism has had quite an influence on you because stories have a lot of power. But we have to take a short break. My guest is Dr. William Keyes IV. He's the author of The Stories They Hear, Expecting Greatness as the Key to Success. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to The Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. William Keyes IV. He's a former senior policy advisor to the White House and founder of the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. He serves on the Board of Trustees at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he's the author of The Stories They Hear, Expecting Greatness as the Key to Success. So, Dr. Keyes, you don't shy away from your faith in this book. In fact, you start the very first chapter with a message of faith. Why was it important to put that message up front?
Mike, you want to know something really funny? I did a book talk in Chapel Hill about a month ago, and the director of UNC Press was there. And someone asked me a question, which was, what did you learn about yourself in the process of writing this book? And I was really stumped by the question because I feel like I'm pretty self-aware and know all about myself. And I struggled to come up with an answer. And at the end of the program, that gentleman, the director of the press, who had read my manuscript, not because I thought an academic press would be appropriate, but just I thought he could give me good advice about how you find a publisher and those sorts of things. And when he walked up to me, I realized the answer that I wish I had thought of earlier about what I learned about myself. And what I learned about myself is I talk about God a lot when I'm talking about my life and my work. So when I had seen that University Press director, he asked me, do you think, you're looking for a Christian publisher? I said, no. Why would you ask me that? He says, because you talk about God a lot. And I said, really? I mean, it didn't even occur to me. And so when I got back to my office, I just pulled up the manuscript and typed in the word God, and it comes up over 200 times. Now, you know, you read the book, and so you can tell me whether you feel like it's something where I'm being preachy. I don't think I am, but it just is the way I talk. I mean, I'm saying to young men, God's blessed you with a lot, and he expects you to use it, not just for you, but to benefit other people. That's just what we talk about.
So let me say this, because there's a spirit that comes through when you speak in that way. And you mentioned that you're part of the Alfred Street Baptist Church.
Yes.
I have a friend who's at the Alfred Street Baptist Church. His name is Keith Moore. And I sent him a message letting him know that we were going to have this conversation. And he had wonderful things to say about you. And he just wanted to say hello.
Oh, wow.
You made a
Talk
connection.
About a small world.
Exactly. But because you were just speaking through that spirit that's in you to say the words and speak the way you do, you never know what kind of connections are going to be made because you were speaking from your heart and speaking honestly. Now, you wrote in your book.
Hey, Mike, can I interrupt you for a second? Because
sure.
There's a chapter in the book about an incident that happened at my church, and that is that we had, I don't want to belabor the story and stretch it out too much, but we had a preacher who came in, and I was really excited about hearing him, and it turns out I thought he delivered one of the worst sermons I'd ever heard in my life. I felt like he was rambling, he was all over the place, and you know, I'm squirming in my seat and peeking at my watch, when on earth is this going to be over? And we do this thing at our church, we call it the call to discipleship. And at the end of the service, we invite people who might want to join our church or give their lives to Christ to walk down that aisle. And our church is a rapidly growing church that has grown from 1,000 members to over 10,000 members just over the last 10 to 15 years. I mean, rapid growth. So we're used to seeing 5 or 10 people walk down that aisle. And after this sermon, you know, that I thought was so bad, 50 people walked down that aisle that day, 50 people. And we got in the car afterward. My wife and I are driving home, and I started crying. And I was thinking, wow, Lord, you did this for me. Meaning, I am often accused mostly by my wife of rambling. And so I sit down around that table, and I'm talking to these young men, 12 juniors, 12 seniors. We're having dinner, and we're having conversations, and I just start talking. I mean, I'll usually have a point that I'm trying to make, but, you know, I'll end up making 12 points. You know, I'm just kind of all over the place, but I'm kind of talking, saying what the Lord is putting on my heart to say. And I realized from that sermon that day that he could have walked in with his 3 points and it could have been very concise and the whole thing and walked out. And maybe 4 or 5 people decided to, you know, join our church or whatever. But he rambled, in my opinion, and 50 people heard what he had to say. And I think the lesson for me was that God was saying, no, you know, people may criticize you for rambling, but the point is for you to say what you need to say. And it's God's business how people hear it. And so I just thought that that was a really important lesson for me. And now, having written this book, I'm getting phone calls from people and text messages from people, many of whom are people I know. And, you know, they're talking about how the book, how these stories are affecting them. And they're different in almost every case. And so there again, you know, the Lord called me to write a book, but it's his business how those words that I've written impact the people who read it. And so, you know, I feel very fortunate that I've been able to say the things that I've said to these young men and also to be able to write this book so other people can hear these stories, read these stories, and be impacted however they're supposed to be impacted and not by some artificial notion that I come up with to say, and this is what I want people to get from the book.
My guest is Dr. William Keyes IV. He's the author of The Stories They Hear, Expecting Greatness as the Key to Success. So, Dr. Keyes, you write a chapter titled, Check Your Perspective. Tell me about that.
You tell me about that. Tell me what that chapter or what that story meant to you.
Well, we have a whole lot more of your book to get into, and so I don't want to hog this time because I have this mic every day.
All right. Well, listen, I will say this. One of the things I think is really important for young people, especially young African-American men, is that they are fed a lot of notions about how other people feel about them. And, you know, my question is, what assumptions are you making about other people's assumptions about you? And so if you walk into a room and you assume that everybody in that room is going to dislike you, they're going to belittle you, they're going to think less of you and all of those things, you're going to behave a certain way when you get into that room, and you're going to relate to everybody a certain way.
You place artificial limitations on yourself.
Exactly, exactly. But if you walk into that room with the expectation that people are happy to have you there, they're looking forward to meeting you, they want to work with you, they've heard great things about you, you know, and all these positive things, then you're going to walk into that room, you're going to behave in a very positive way, and you're going to engage people in a positive way. And what I've found, what I've observed in way too many cases, is that young people make negative assumptions about other people's assumptions about them, and those negative assumptions are often wrong, but they become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so I'm trying to get people to make the assumption. What I say to them is, look, I wake up every morning, I take a shower, I get dressed, I look in the mirror, and I see a man who I think deserves to be respected. And so, therefore, when I walk out the door, I'm assuming everybody's seeing the same man that I just saw in the mirror, that everybody else is going to respect me. And what I found is that that's exactly the case. And in some cases, people have gone way beyond just being respectful. They've been downright deferential. But it starts with what I think about myself. And not enough young Black men are being taught that lesson. They're being taught the exact opposite. So my job is to disrupt those stories that they've heard in the past and tell them other positive stories.
You have a chapter cautioning the reader to not be offended, which is followed by another chapter titled, Really, Don't Be Offended. Tell me about that.
Well, first of all, I am unoffendable. You simply cannot offend me. You know, even if you're trying to insult me, I'm probably going to laugh because I'm thinking you're joking, right? And it goes back to what I said a second ago. I woke up and I looked in the mirror and I saw a man who deserved to be respected. And I'm assuming everybody else sees that same man. But why do people get offended so easily? And you know, there have been cases where people have told me that I offended them somehow. And I would say, wow, I didn't intend to. Why are you offended? And then I realized afterward that their offense had nothing to do with me. It had to do with their own insecurities or their own shortcomings. And I said something that sparked that. But it wasn't something that really came from me.
So there's a high level of sensitivity within them.
It's a high level of sensitivity. No, you're exactly right. And so I'm saying to the young men I work with, if you are that easily offended, it is not my job to go tell 20,000 other students on your college campus that they need to not say a certain thing. My job is to ask you why it is that someone could say something to you that would cause you to feel that way about things. So if you are highly motivated to do something with your life that's really, really, really important, there's probably not anything that somebody can say to you that's going to get you off track. And I hear this all the time that people are, well, I couldn't even function because someone said this or did this to me. And I ask these young men, okay, what can you tell LeBron James that's going to keep him from being in the gym tomorrow?
Okay,
Not one single thing. So then I'll ask them, and so your goal is to be a surgeon who's going to treat people. Why is it that someone can say something to you that's going to get you off track?
So let me build on that. You have a chapter titled, High Self-Esteem Comes from High Achievement.
Yes, absolutely. If you are working hard and you're achieving a lot, some kid, you know, on campus is not going to be able to say something that's going to get you off track because you know who you are. High self-worth comes from high achievement. High self-esteem also comes from, you know, hearing the praise of people who you hold in high regard. And so our institute scholars for years and years went to visit with Congressman John Lewis, who is a civil rights icon. They went to meet with General Colin Powell, you know, who's a trailblazer in so many ways. And hearing people like that say very positive things to them about who they are and their place in the world, if you walked out of those meetings without your self-esteem being raised, you aren't listening or you got some kind of a problem.
You advise your reader to embrace your potential to be great.
Yes. No, that's exactly it. But I want them to be great for reasons that are bigger than themselves. I talk to them all the time about the investment that they're working in them, that we are making in them, which we're very, very happy to make. We pay for their 2-summer experience in Washington. We provide for their housing and meals. We give them a stipend of $5,000 to live on for the 8 weeks that they're here. And at the end of their second summer here, we provide $20,000, which is invested, and they have to sign an agreement that they won't touch the money for 10 years because we want them to see that investment grow so that they start understanding the importance of building wealth, and we give them a head start on building wealth. Attacking the wealth gap is something that's really important to me. But we tell them, we're going to do all of this not because you're so great that you deserve it. We're doing it because we think that you have the potential to go out and do something amazing with your life that's going to be a blessing in the lives of many, many other people. And that may be hundreds of thousands of people. It may be millions of people. So let's just think about it. The person who's a teacher or a professor, it's not an investment in them. It's an investment in all the students that they will teach and all the people that those students' lives will impact. You know, if you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, whatever the field is, it's about the impact that you're going to have in other people's lives.
Dr. Keyes,
so,
we have 1 minute left. And
I
want you to touch on this. You advise your readers to bring others along, but you also advise them to finish strong and thank profusely.
Yes, finish strong. I guess that's what you want me to do for this interview, finish strong. Listen, one of the things is they spend a full summer at an internship. Some of them are going to work really hard, do really well over the course of the first several weeks. And then toward the end, they start coasting because they've heard people tell them how great they are. And I say to them, listen, if you are a goof off for that last week, it will undo all the good work you did for the first 7 weeks. That's how life is. We have to continue to work hard, to do well, to achieve a lot, and finish our lives strong. So that's the story for them. The stories they hear, that's the book. Hopefully folks will read it and hear a lot more of these stories.
Well, I appreciate you writing the book. I had a good time reading it. I'm going to read it to my boys as well. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. So I want to thank you profusely, Dr. Keyes, for joining me.
Thank you so much. And call me after you've read the book to your sons and tell me how they received it.
I would love to do that. My guest was Dr. William Keyes IV. He's a former senior policy advisor to the White House and founder of the Institute for Responsible Citizenship. He serves on the Board of Trustees at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he's the author of The Stories They Hear, Expecting Greatness as the Key to Success. I'm Mike Green.